It's The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon from WNYC News, in for Tanzina Vega. Last year, all around the country, people took to the streets in an unprecedented uprising for racial justice. After the police killing of George Floyd, the Black Lives Matter movement reignited in all 50 states. And we also saw brutal crackdowns by the police on protesters. In just the first few days of demonstrations, police around the U.S. arrested more than 10,000 protesters, many for violating curfews and failing to disperse.
We have a group of people blocking traffic on Albany and Dean Street. They're refusing to let the arm go eastbound, so we're stuck here.
Run them over.
Shut the f- Don't put that over yet.
And this year, the police killings have continued, and so have the protests. That's a Columbus, Ohio protest against the police shooting of 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant last week. But as demonstrations continue in the U.S., some lawmakers around the country are looking at stricter legal penalties for protesting. Oklahoma and Iowa recently passed laws that grant immunity to people who strike protesters with their cars. And in Florida last week, Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation to create harsher penalties for existing public disorder laws.
We're not having riots in the state of Florida. And so we put our foot down, we protected our folks. If a local government tries to defund the police, we at the state can stop that. We're able to put people in jail if they riot or assault a police officer. And in fact, if you assault a police officer during a riot, you have a mandatory jail sentence of at least 6 months. I think it's probably the most comprehensive piece of law and order legislation I've seen.
He can't breathe! He can't breathe! He can't breathe!
We're going to talk about this wave of anti-protest legislation with civil rights attorney Nora Benavides, the director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at PEN America. Nora, great to have you.
Hey, Nancy. Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined by Ellie Page, senior legal advisor at the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, and its U.S. Protest Law Tracker. Ellie, great to have you here as well.
Hi, Nancy. Great to be here.
So let's start with you, Ellie. I want to run through some of these recent laws one at a time. So let's start with the law in Oklahoma. What does that one do?
So the law in Oklahoma is one of many that we've seen, particularly in the last 8 months since last summer and the murder of George Floyd, that would essentially enable violence against protesters by limiting the consequences for drivers who injure or kill protesters with their car, allowing them to avoid both criminal or civil consequences in some cases. So we've seen at least 15 bills since last summer's protests that use that tactic. It essentially means that someone who recklessly drives over a protester can avoid any charges as long as they are acting unintentionally.
Wow. That's just mind-boggling to me. And Nora, tell us about the Florida law.
Sure. So, you know, Florida has really inspired many, in my count, 21 other proposals around the country. Governor Ron DeSantis introduced this very influential anti-protest policy in December. And when he did that, he announced that really this was aimed at professional agitators. Included in his proposal, he tried to put forward 11 different measures that would somehow punish protest-related activity. At the time, that included making blocking traffic punishable by up to 5 years in prison, making destroying or toppling monuments during a protest punishable by up to 15 years in prison. It would provide immunity immunity for drivers who hit demonstrators, which is a recurring provision that we are seeing. And then it would also open local governments to lawsuits if they were negligent in protecting people and property, essentially kind of creating the incentive to make sure that there is enough police presence during protests.
Isn't there also a local provision about any town that would reduce police funding? Is that part of this as well?
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's really kind of a 1-2 punch, finding as many ways to incentivize, quote unquote, enough police presence so that those that are protesting might otherwise think twice about actually protesting for fear of some very large police presence and a force that is not able to reduce its funding. I think that's really a clear response to the BLM and the Defund the Police movement.
Ellie, what's considered a riot under the Florida law, and who has the discretion to decide this?
It's a great question. So the law creates a sweeping new definition of riot that can capture folks who are protesting completely peacefully. If a group that they're part of is deemed essentially to pose a threat to property or people. So if you have a large group that police decide poses a threat of property damage, anyone in that group can face second degree felony charges, which means 15 years in prison, potentially. And likewise, if that group is blocking traffic during what is deemed a quote unquote riot, that's another second degree felony. It's a problem that we've seen. It's an issue that we've seen across the country in initiatives that would expand the legal definition of riot in ways that can capture purely peaceful, legitimate protest activity.
And to your knowledge, Nora, are there any laws related to the January 6th Capitol uprising, or is it mostly related to Black Lives Matter protests?
Well, that's such a great question because, you know, our state legislative sessions began in January. And so we saw dozens and dozens of new anti-protest policies introduced in the wake of January 6th. But I think that it would really be a false equivalency to say that those, the Capitol insurrection and then the Black Lives Matter and the George Floyd protests are one and the same. From my research, really, we only have seen one bill, and that is out of Connecticut, that would explicitly take on criminalizing certain activities like taking papers from a state legislature or from chambers. So really, that means that the playbook has been the same as it's been since 2017 for state legislators to introduce policies that really roll back our rights, whether it's, you know, creating greater penalties, as Ellie says, or creating new types of penalties, not just steeper ones. These are the types of policies that aren't necessarily in response to January 6th, but in response to progressive racial justice movements.
Is anyone raising the fact that many of these same states allow protesters to carry guns? I mean, isn't that a bit hypocritical?
Well, that's one of the main progressive talking points now. Many people have kind of tried to, you know, shine a light on that. And if you think back to our anti-lockdown protesters in Michigan who stormed their state capitol armed with guns, our former president, Donald Trump, said they were very fine people, all the while turning and looking at George Floyd protesters, Black Lives Matter protesters, calling them thugs. And so I think there's this very clear animus that is viewpoint specific, that if you have a certain message, you will more likely be seen as somehow criminal. And we're trying to undo that misconception.
Let's talk about the proposed bill in Minnesota. This is, of course, where George Floyd was killed and where many, many protests were held after that. Nora, tell us about the bill that's proposed in Minnesota.
Well, there are so many bills in Minnesota, and it's really been a hotspot state for many anti-protest policies, from the critical infrastructure types of proposals that would make someone, you know, near a critical infrastructure site also criminal, highway obstruction bills. Specifically, though, new pending legislation would increase costs for protesters, and it would make obstructing a highway or interfering with traffic vehicles new and enhanced penalties.
And so the Republicans who are proposing and in many cases passing these laws, what are they saying to justify this?
Well, as we've seen, you know, Governor DeSantis mentioned that what, you know, many of these bills are supposed to enhance public safety, to really create a space where speech can thrive. Governor DeSantis said specifically that we needed to protect against these agitators bent on sowing disorder and causing mayhem in our cities. Other legislators have been quick to also say that we need to protect our citizens. We need to rally together to make sure that these riots aren't happening. But when we look at the numbers, when we look at what happened this past summer, our friends like ACLED, the Armed Conflict Centers, have explicitly said that 93% of the protests last summer were actually peaceful. So we're really kind of legislating and trying to correct a problem that doesn't exist.
And Ellie, where do you see what is the specific groups and the specific political ideologies that are being targeted here? I mean, what evidence do we have that this is really about Black Lives Matter and not other kinds of protests?
Yeah, thank you, Nancy. I think we've repeatedly seen lawmakers seek to silence specific protest movements instead of engaging with the concerns that have motivated people to turn out. And with this wave of bills, I mean, it's no exception. Lawmakers have made very clear that they're responding to last summer's protests against systemic racism. We know this from the statements by lawmakers themselves, which often conflate last summer's, as Nora points out, overwhelmingly peaceful protests with looting and violence. And then the text of the bills, the fact that they're targeting street protests, they're raising penalties for blocking traffic, they're making it easier for people to hit protesters with their cars, and targeting large and quote-unquote disorderly protests.
I still can't get over the hitting people with their cars. I mean, has there been pushback even? I mean, I would expect Republican voters to be a little wary of that one. Are we seeing any pushback coming from other than the progressive camp on that?
I mean, you would hope to see pushback from all sides of the political spectrum, because this is these are proposals that would threaten a right that's enjoyed by all Americans. This is not purely a right and a freedom that enjoyed by protesters on the left. So whether it's reopen protesters or anti-abortion protesters, I mean, they're exercising the same right under threat now.
It seems like a majority of these laws are trying to protect private property from vandalism. Is that an accurate assessment of what's going on?
I think these proposals are trying to do a lot, actually, whether it's protecting private property or making penalties so steep for someone that would be obstructing traffic, or even strip people of their public benefits and access to state benefits that they feel they can't really protest. Many of these contain so many disparate and far-reaching provisions. It isn't just about protecting property. It's about fundamentally making people feel like the risk of protesting is so great that they likely shouldn't do it.
Now, of course, there are laws on the books already for protecting property or, and arson, violence. Are there any places where there needs to be improvement, where things happen during protests that where we need tighter laws?
That's one of my favorite questions. And no, all of these states have existing misdemeanor laws on the books, which means if you do obstruct traffic, that is already a low-level misdemeanor in all of these states. The proposals that we're talking about today are really just juicing up the penalties for people for things that already exist as criminal penalties, and often will just, you know, be further reason for people to think twice. So it's such a good question, and I think it really kind of begs the bigger question of why legislators are doing this.
Ellie, are people around the country challenging these laws? What's going on to fight back against them?
Yeah, so we know that where these laws have passed, I mean, already in Florida, where DeSantis signed their new law last week, already folks have brought constitutional challenges against the law. And we know that advocates are gearing up in other states where these laws are threatening to pass to do the same. But it's risky. You know, litigation is not a sure thing. And I think the number one priority and challenge right now is ensuring that these bills don't pass in the first place. I mean, we have an overwhelming wave of legislation. We've seen over 90 bills introduced in 35 states since last summer. It's an unprecedented wave, both in terms of the number of bills introduced, the extent to which they're moving through legislatures and passing, and the extreme lengths they go to restrict and chill protest rights.
Do you have a number of how many states? I mean, 90 bills spread across how many states?
35 states.
Wow, that's a lot. Yep. So, Nora, what are the First Amendment implications of these types of laws?
Well, you know, everyone often feels like protest is, you know, an activity for people who feel otherwise, that their voices aren't heard. And I think it's important for us to take a step back and remember why we protest. You know, we often come together, we express ourselves when we feel like our cause is one that is not getting attention or recognition. And so it's important to see that our First Amendment rights, and specifically the freedom of assembly, is one that we really should be upholding, protecting, and viewing as sacred in this country, because it's so fundamental to the way that we conceive of how we engage with democracy. And yet, mostly these proposals would in some way make it harder to come out and demonstrate. Not all of these proposals, however, are, I would say, slam dunk unconstitutional proposals. They often are proposals where I'm worried about the way they will be applied. We do not know yet, given that only about 20% of the anti-protest bills proposed since 2017 have actually become law. We're still in a holding pattern. We're waiting to see how some of these bills will be applied by law enforcement. But Florida was so quick to pass this. The governor was so explicit in his saying that we are targeting the Black Lives Matter protests and George Floyd protests, that I think it's really an easy conclusion to see how these proposals, even if they are maybe able to pass constitutional muster, they will actually be applied in incredibly uneven ways, targeting specific speech and specific movements.
So when you say waiting, I assume that means that there is no challenge that's yet working its way through the courts.
There are active lawsuits now in Florida challenging the Florida law on its face, to say that the way that this does a number of things violates our First Amendment rights. And I am very hopeful that that suit goes well, because I think it's a really powerful one. But across the board, you know, because there are so few of these bills that have become law, we're still just very worried about how they'll be applied. And there are differences. You can try to challenge a law on its face the moment it becomes law, and then you can try to challenge something once it's been used. And that's where I get concerned, of course, about how law enforcement will pick and choose the kinds of speech that will be acceptable to them.
Well, and that was my next question, but I think you might have just answered it. So that's why this is seen as this could be disproportional, because it's going to be up to police to decide when and where they use these new laws. Is that why it becomes very disproportional?
Yeah, absolutely. So many vague provisions, you know, that someone could be, for example, guilty of unlawful assembly. Well, assembly is baked into our First Amendment. So unlawful assembly is really an oxymoron. And to imagine a situation where an officer says that's unlawful, but this over here is not, those vague terms give police incredible discretion.
Okay, I'm afraid we have to end it there. Nora Benavidez is a civil rights attorney and director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at PEN America. And Ellie Page is senior legal advisor at the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law and its U.S. Protest Law Tracker. Nora, Ellie, great to have you both.
Thanks so much, Nancy.
Thank you, Nancy.
In the 24 hours following the guilty verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial, at least six people were killed by police. That's according to a report by the Associated Press. The first documented case was that of Micaiah Bryant, a black teenager in Columbus, Ohio, who was fatally shot minutes before the judge read the Chauvin verdict publicly. Protesters in Columbus took to the streets instantly to demand accountability. And while many questions remain about this case in particular, it's clear that the community, still reeling from the police shootings of Casey Goodson Jr. and Andre Hill, are on edge. For more on this, I'm joined by Farnoosh Amiri, a reporter for the Associated Press and the Report for America Statehouse Initiative. Farnoosh, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with Micaiah Bryant. You've listened to the 911 call, you watched the body and dash cam footage. What do we know about what led to this fatal encounter?
So the information that we have starts from minutes before the officers show up to the foster home where Micaiah Bryant and her sister were living at and where the 911 call was made. The majority of the events happened within 11 seconds of the officer showing up. So Officer Nicholas Reardon of the Columbus Division of Police is seen on his body camera getting out of the vehicle, and there's a group of people gathered on the driveway of the home. And in less than seconds, you see 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant lunging towards another girl who falls to the ground before she moves on to another girl. And who's pushed up against a car. And in those 11 seconds, those two things happen, and Officer Reardon shoots Micaiah Bryant in the chest four times, and she falls to the ground.
And what's still unclear or remains a question about what happened?
There's a lot unclear. There's a lot who called 911. Micaiah Bryant's family tells us that she did, that she and her sister were home when these two girls showed up, antagonizing them and threatening them and their foster mom. So that still remains extremely unclear, because if it was Micaiah who called 911 or her sister, and that was their foster home, Ohio has stand your ground laws. So that could be a potential legal defense that her family or any sort of legal team could use.
So you were at the scene shortly after all this happened. What can you tell us about how the police are handling things and how the community is responding?
So the press and the majority of the public did not know the name of the victim or the circumstances of what happened until close to midnight, the night of the shooting. Columbus police told reporters to meet them downtown at their headquarters, where they, within 5 hours of the shooting, showed a glimpse of the body camera footage that Officer Reardon had taken. And that was really striking, because Columbus police has only had body cameras since 2016. But even with that, they put it out routinely and quickly in comparison to other major city police departments. But this, within 5 hours, it was clear that there was a defense that they had. They wanted to lower tensions. They knew that there would be protests. They had already been preparing for protests in case the Chauvin trial would have gone a different way. So, you know, the city and the police department were under immense scrutiny. So they, I'm assuming the mayor and the police chief, watched the video. And what they saw was a defense for Officer Reardon, in their view and in their eyes. He potentially saved the life of the second girl who they say that was about to be stabbed.
So Micaiah Bryant isn't the only person who's been killed by police in and around Columbus, Ohio, in recent months. There were two other fatal police shootings back in December. Tell us about those.
So on December 3rd, 23-year-old Casey Goodson Jr. was fatally shot by a Franklin County sheriff's deputy. That case is quite different than the other ones because the county sheriff's department does not have body cameras. They immediately after that shooting, the county approved money to get those body cameras. But without that, there is only the side of the family and the side of the officer about what happened. That case was a really complicated one because it appears that the deputy was not on duty with either the sheriff's office, according to what they say, or the U.S. Marshal Task Force that he was with when he saw Casey. And he said that Casey waved a gun at him while driving by. So that case remains under federal investigation. We still don't have any idea where that's going to go. And shortly after, 2 to 3 weeks later, 47-year-old Andre Hill was shot by a Columbus police officer while walking out of a garage of a friend's house that he was staying at after a 911 call was made about someone turning their car on and off. The officer in that case says that he thought Hill was holding a gun. It turned out he was holding a cell phone.
And that officer, Adam Coy, has been charged with murder. So where does that case stand at this point?
He's been charged with murder. So the next hearing in the case, which is mostly a procedural hearing, is Wednesday, actually. And that's kind of when we'll find out where the trial goes from here, what it will be, the dates set up. And it's kind of a what happens next type of hearing.
What are the people in Columbus calling for? Are they asking for specific reforms at this point?
I think the majority of activists and advocates in this field and in the city believe that there is just no reforming police at this point. They don't feel that Columbus police represent them or live within their communities or understand the nuances of this community. I mean, specifically with Micaiah Bryant, she was in foster care, and that on itself is a very specific case of situations going on within this community, within young people, that advocates believe police don't get and police aren't cognizant of. So I think the city has reached a boiling point from what advocates and activists tell me. I don't know what really could change for them systematically that would be enough or quick enough at this point.
Well, at the state level, in the wake of the killing of George Floyd last year, Governor Mike DeWine, a Republican, talked about police reform. He spoke about it again this weekend after the shooting of Micaiah Bryant. Is there support for this in the state house, with both controlled by the Republicans, both the House and the state Senate? What's going on at the state level?
So Governor Mike DeWine, within days of George Floyd's killing, him and the attorney general, who's also a Republican, got up and you know, issued plans for sweeping police reform as far as, you know, creating a police oversight board, professionalizing police, having a certification system, and kind of just like similar to medical boards where there can be complaints on a statewide basis. And what Governor DeWine really wanted and what he's continued to highlight is he wants to make sure that there's a stop to the fact that an officer can do, whether it's criminally or just, you know, wrongdoing, negligence in his job, and be able to go from one department to another. So that's something that Governor Mike DeWine has made really clear. What happened shortly after those reforms were introduced last year is kind of nothing. The Senate and the House are controlled by Republicans. It was a pandemic. There was a federal bribery investigation that happened. There was a lot that was happening, and police reform kind of got put on the back burner. And I don't know if it's the top priority for Republicans who control both chambers.
Okay. Farnoosh Amiri is a reporter for the Associated Press and the Report for America Statehouse Initiative. Thanks, Farnoosh.
Thank you.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Last night, Hollywood celebrated a very unusual year for the industry at the 93rd Academy Awards. Nomadland ended up taking home the award for Best Picture. This year's ceremony also came just weeks after an exposé was published in The Hollywood Reporter, featuring extensive allegations of abusive behavior and bullying by Oscar-winning film, TV, and theater producer Scott Rudin. Even if you don't know Rudin's name, the chances are high that you've seen something he worked on. His credits include Sister Act, School of Rock, and No Country for Old Men, among many others. He's part of a small group of people who have won an Emmy, Oscar, Grammy, and Tony. Former employees of Rudin allege that the producer created an extremely hostile workplace. While Rudin did not comment on the Hollywood Reporter article, he did issue a statement to the Washington Post apologizing for his treatment of employees and also stating that he'll be stepping away from a number of projects he had in the works. In a few minutes, we'll speak with two of those former employees. First, we're joined by Tatiana Siegel, executive film editor at The Hollywood Reporter, who broke the story on Scott Rudin's allegedly abusive behavior. Tatiana, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Nancy.
So tell us some of the specific stories that you were told by former assistants of Scott Rudin that really stuck with you.
You know, it was a lot of thrown objects. That's kind of the thing that stuck with me, is that sort of intimidation of knowing that an object could be hurled at you at any moment. I heard people tell me about staplers, baked potatoes, a glass bowl, a teacup. There were just anything that he could get in his line of reach that he would, you know, throw at employees. And it was terrifying.
And actually sent at least one employee to the emergency room?
Two that I'm aware of. One was because he smashed a Apple monitor onto the hand of an assistant and it shattered. And that assistant was taken to an emergency room in New York. And another employee had a panic attack due to stress and was taken away in an ambulance and never returned.
So his behavior has been described as an open secret in Hollywood. So why do you think it hadn't been reported before or extensively reported before?
You know, that's a question I can't answer because it should have been. It was something that I know, at least in the post-Me Too era of 2017 and on, people were looking closely into behaviors that no longer would be considered acceptable. And he was somebody that by all means should have been exposed because the behavior continued. And I know that at least one outlet had been working on an expose and it was shelved somewhat mysteriously. And it was something that was ripe for the picking.
You wrote a little bit about how some of the ways that Rudin allegedly swept his behavior under the rug. So how did that prevent people from going public in the past?
I think what kept people from going public in the past was more the threat of non-disclosure agreements and non-disparagement agreements that every employee had to sign. When I got people to talk on the record, there was definitely that concern. But I think that people at this point were just ready to tell their story. Enough is enough. And the fact that it was continuing to go on years after what would be considered Hollywood's reckoning was something that people who had worked there were just finally ready to speak about.
We're hearing now from many assistants of Rudin, but what about the big name stars that have worked with him over the years? Has anyone come out and responded to him and his behavior?
No, it has been pretty much crickets across the board. And that is somewhat shocking because Hollywood has been very vocal on a number of issues. And here is something that one would think would be clearly easy to comment on. And yet everyone has remained pretty much quiet. Hugh Jackman, who was ready to do a play with Scott Rudin, the Music Man on Broadway, finally issued a statement after, you know, a week or so of people writing about the fact that Hugh Jackman still hadn't commented. And he wrote a statement or presented a statement that was pretty, like, you know, barely a statement, you know, nothing forceful or, wow, this behavior is something that is just horrific. It was more like, I'm glad Scott Rudin stepped away from the play. But, you know, it is quite shocking and has not gone without people noticing the fact that Hollywood remains silent about this.
And to what extent do you think this behavior is widespread in Hollywood? I mean, how typical is it with other producers and executives?
Based on the responses I've received since my cover story ran, I guess I would say it's pretty widespread. I don't think anybody, to my knowledge, was as prolific an abuser of his staff as Scott Rudin, but definitely I'm getting a lot of responses now, do fill in the blank. You know, there's a lot of people who have been mistreated, and not in a way like, oh, you know, so-and-so was asked to order lunch for them and that was demeaning. It's like, you know, just horrible yelling at people and, you know, making them feel completely worthless, throwing them out of meetings and humiliating them in front of talent, and the kind of behavior that it would really kind of qualify as just sadistic, pointless, not helping make a project go any faster or better.
Tatiana Siegel is the executive film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
With me now to discuss their experiences are Evan Davis and Amanda Pasquini, who both worked as assistants to Scott Rudin. Evan, Amanda, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with you, Evan. You worked for Rudin in 2012. Let's start at the beginning. How did he treat you in the first days on the job?
Well, it didn't take a long time for the behavior that I had been told about to emerge. I think it took about 24 hours, which I'm also told is a long time for his abuse to start showing up. And it's as exactly as everyone has described. It's beratings, screaming, through every media you can imagine, to your face, over email, texting, on the phone, pretty much at all hours of the day. You had to be available for 16 or 17 hours a day for him to be in contact with you. And it was relentless. It was exhausting. And you quickly forgot that this wasn't normal behavior, because this is all that you experienced every single minute you were in that office.
And did you see any of the physical violence that's been described, the throwing of objects, the injuring of people?
I personally did not, but that is not to say that that wasn't completely normal and that those stories aren't completely believable and credible. There was just too much of that negativity and that kind of energy, and also enough stories from current and former employees for you not to believe that happened.
Amanda, what about you? You started work there in 2017. What was Scott Rudin's initial behavior like towards you?
Well, actually, my first week was like a dream, because he was on vacation. So my first week, I was actually by myself with the other assistants. And like a lot of people lay out in the multiple articles that have come forward, the assistants, it's like a brotherhood. I mean, everyone looks out for each other, and they certainly prepared me for what was to come. My interview, one of my colleagues said to me, if you get fired in the first couple of days, it's truly not personal. That just happens. And I knew nothing about him going into the job. I had never heard of him. I was actually having a really hard time finding work. I was a very early career professional, which seems to kind of be the people that they were employing at the time as assistants. But from the moment that he stepped in the door and I met him, every day of my job moving forward, I was wrong about something. There was no success in that position.
And did you know going in a little bit about him, or was it just hearing from other coworkers that you learned of the toxic work environment?
I knew absolutely nothing about him. I think I Googled him on my way to the interview in the elevator. The first thing that came up was, worst bosses of NYC. And I was feeling a certain way while I was in there. That office and that my time there, I always say, feels like a fever dream from the moment they handed me a Fiji water in my interview to my month there as an assistant. It was quite a roller coaster.
Sounds like it. So what was the structure like within the workplace? Were there higher up employees that you could speak to about Rudin's behavior?
Technically, there could have been. I mean, he had a human resources manager on staff who would onboard you. But it's a very small office. And I think that was a very deliberate decision on his part to keep it small in order to control the people below him and make sure that there wouldn't be a chain of command that could circumvent his behavior or place a check on his behavior. There's only about a dozen people in the office at any one time. And we all reported directly to him. There was no filter. You, aside from the solidarity you felt with your other assistants, as Amanda pointed out, you had no other recourse, particularly when, for example, when I was there, we heard about a workplace termination lawsuit by a former employee that was in process. But as a development executive said, Scott's too rich and has too many lawyers for him to worry about it. Once you hear that, you kind of realize that there really is no redress for your grievances. We certainly weren't unionized, that's for darn sure. We just didn't have any other choice, especially when you're told by others in the industry, if you can survive this job, and that is the language that's often used, if you can survive for a year, your career will be set. You can write your own ticket in Hollywood. Those are really effective tools to make sure that you don't step out of line too far.
So do you think that's why it took so long for this to all come out, that people kind of treated it as, okay, I have to go pay my dues and take the abuse, but then I'm going to profit from it in my career later?
Well, I think that's certainly part of it. Another part of it is that I know that many former employees were required to sign non-disclosure agreements. I personally was not, which is why I'm a little bit more comfortable speaking on the record than maybe some other employees are. I think another part of it is that talent is very, very supportive of him. Tatiana mentioned in her segment how very few, practically no talent, actors, writers, directors who work with him are willing to speak up about his behavior because he has been so successful for them, either in making money for them or in ensuring that their projects see the light of day. He works in film, but he also works in television and theater. He has a very wide network of talent that he works for.
Well, we're almost out of time. So, Amanda, I wanted to be sure to get to this. So, you know, we've been told that the hostile workplace was particularly bad for women and people of color. How do you feel you were treated as a woman compared to your male colleagues?
Yes, I would love to comment on how just incredibly brave it was for a lot of the women to come forward in the Hollywood Reporter expose, where all of this kind of started. My experience as a woman there, something that I just want to make sure is included, his attitude trickled down. That environment is how future leaders were made. So the male colleagues that I worked with, they were watching this man succeed by treating women this way, and they went on to build their careers. So yes, was I treated differently, and was I treated in my own experience poorly compared to my male colleagues? Yes, and I believe that he planted a seed in some of the people I worked with for them to take that to other institutions or other companies that they were working with.
And did you see a pattern where men moved on and women were kind of run out of the industry because of the abuse?
I saw my male colleagues kind of cheered on while I was made to repeat my mistakes to him, like a school child, or told constantly in my own experience that everything I was doing was wrong, that I've been doing things wrong for 6 or 7 weeks when I had only worked there for 3, just kind of like making it out to be, you know, and I think like Evan said, that's kind of how he controls the assistants, just making them believe that it's, you're kind of worthless. And, you know, in my own experience, that certainly rang true.
Amanda Pasquini and Evan Davis are former assistants to Scott Rudin. Evan, Amanda, thanks so much for sharing your stories with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've reached out to Scott Rudin's team for a statement. We'll post it on thetakeaway.org when they respond. That's a wrap, folks. It's great being here with you guys. Please keep calling us about show ideas or suggestions. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nancy Solomon, and this is The Takeaway.